We started last Sunday a new series. We launched into Mark. If you didn't get a chance to hear that, it's on the internet. You can go back and listen to the podcast online. And the title of our series is Follow Me, subtitle, Lessons for Disciples from the Gospel of Mark. And today we get to really kind of the heart of the series. We're going to be looking at Mark chapter 1 and verse 16. Before we go there, I want to get you thinking about something. If I were to hand out this morning little pieces of paper and pens, and if I were to ask each one of you to write down in one sentence your definition of discipleship, and then if I were to hand those forward and start reading them, my guess is what we would find is something around 250 different definitions of discipleship, right? Now, some of you, as you think, like, what would I write? You know, there's all kinds of possibilities. Maybe you would focus on this idea of kind of the one-on-one mentoring type of a relationship. Maybe you have in your head Paul and his relationship with Timothy, which is a real picture of discipleship in the Bible. And maybe for you, that's really a significant idea of discipleship. Or maybe when you think of discipleship, you really focus in on that word discipline. And for you, maybe discipleship has to do with the disciplines of the Christian faith. Learning how to pray, learning how to read the Bible, fasting, giving, all these different ideas. Maybe that's what your definition would look like. Or maybe for you, as you think about discipleship, it's fundamentally about what you know about Jesus. Christian theology, learning to understand what the Bible teaches. And it's all about getting as much information as you possibly can. But I can guarantee you there's one thing we can all agree on. It's that even among really wonderful Christian people, there are varying definitions of discipleship. And you know what that means? That means that if we're going to embark on a series where we're going to focus on discipleship, it's very possible that we have a problem right at the beginning, and it's the problem of a lack of clarity on what we're even talking about. A lack of clarity. And I, as I've thought about this and as I prayed about this morning, I realized it's not just that we might not all agree on what discipleship means. I think there's even a bigger problem, and I think of it as almost like there are obstacles for Christian people today to the idea of discipleship. There are hindrances that maybe keep the average you and I type of a Christian from really thinking about our lives in terms of Christian discipleship. I think that in many ways, discipleship is kind of like the maiden who's trapped in the ivory tower. Discipleship has been kidnapped and lifted where it's kind of out of reach and it's out of touch and it seems beyond the scope, beyond the realm of you and I, the average Christian. And this is why I'm so excited about the Gospel of Mark. Because Mark, what Mark is going to do is Mark is going to scale the wall of the ivory tower. It's like a rescue mission where Mark wants to go up, capture back something as beautiful as discipleship and bring it right back down to a level where you and I can really engage and see the joy of it, the beauty of it, and feel like this is a part of my Christian experience. Okay? So now, will you read with me chapter 1? We're going to focus this week and next week. We're going to do a two-part series on this passage, chapter 1, verses 16 to 20. There's a lot going on here. Will you read with me? Here's how Mark describes Jesus, the disciple maker. Passing alongside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on a little further, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in their boat mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants, and they followed him. Right out of the gate, we come to realize discipleship is going to be a central theme in Mark's story. Think about this. What is the very first major thing that Jesus does? He doesn't do a miracle. He doesn't write in the sky. He doesn't do an amazing healing. He doesn't preach an epic sermon. What does Jesus do to launch his ministry as the Son of God on planet Earth? He begins to go and call people to follow him, and he forms the nucleus of a new community of people who will be called disciples. Disciples. And from verse 16 to the end of the gospel, this is going to be one of the major focuses of Mark. He's going to show us Jesus for sure. But all along the way, we're seeing Jesus. And what we're seeing is we're seeing a Jesus who is calling people into relationship and then shaping them in this idea of discipleship. And we realize this is Mark's main idea. And this needs to be what we're going to learn from the gospel of Mark. But here's what's fascinating. Mark never defines discipleship. It's a major theme in his gospel, and yet there is never a moment where he stops and says, oh, and by the way, in case you're confused, here is my definition of discipleship. I wrote it down with a pencil on a piece of paper. No, he never gives you a definition of discipleship. Instead, Mark shows us discipleship through an incredible story. He shows us what discipleship is. Do you know the difference? So let me use an illustration. Let's imagine that I wanted you to understand what the Timbers Army is, which I really do. I want you to understand this, okay? The Timbers Army. Some of you are like, I don't even know what you're talking about. The Timbers Army. Let's say I wanted you to know what the Timbers Army was. Well, I could do a couple of things. The first thing I could do is I could read to you the definition from Wikipedia, which I'm going to do right now, okay? Here we go. The Timbers Army is an independent supporters group of the Portland Timbers, a football, in parentheses, soccer club in Major League Soccer. Its members are known for their loud, enthusiastic support and the ruckus atmosphere they create at a Timbers game, okay? And I could read that to you, and you would just go, you would have no idea the glory of the Timbers Army. You wouldn't get it, okay? So I could do that, or better yet, I could take you to a Timbers game, and we could sit in the army together. They kick at 11:30, okay, today. Did you know this? The Timbers kick at 11:30. There are buses outside right now. No, I'm kidding. I took my daughter, Lauren, to a Timbers game, and I took her to the Timbers Army section, much to the chagrin of my loving bride, Kathy, okay? I took Lauren, and I took her because I have a philosophy of parenting that says that we should allow our children to experience in small doses the sin of a fallen world, okay? So I thought, what better way to do that than to take Lauren and show her the Timbers Army, you know? Because there's no way to experience it like being there, the smells of the Timbers Army, the sights of the sounds, the colorful metaphors that you learn, you know? Where else are you going to see a man, a grown man with a chainsaw cutting through wood, epic beards, the whole thing? I took Lauren, and it was not because I wanted to go at all, okay? It was purely an act of love for my daughter. But think about this for a minute. How much better would it be to be taken on a tour, like a living tour of discipleship through a really well-told story, a really well-told story, where you experience discipleship in the front row, in the splash zone, and as Mark tells his story, and by story, I don't mean I don't mean fiction. I mean a retelling of the real events of Jesus and his disciples. And the way that Mark tells the story, it's gripping and compelling. And as you read, you're reading and it's fast paced and he moves and he describes Jesus as a man of action, a man with a mission, a man who's moving quickly. And he's calling people and he's training them. And you're in the front row watching this thing unfold. And you begin to realize, I'm not getting some Webster's dictionary definition of discipleship. I'm getting a painting, a portrait. And what I want you to see over the next 14 weeks is that Mark is a really gifted storyteller. That's why I asked you to read Mark if you can. Try to read the whole gospel in one sitting. I got an email on Monday morning last week after I put out that challenge, and the title of the email was Out of Breath. And a woman said, I sat down to read Mark, and by the end of chapter one, I felt like I was out of breath because it moves so fast, and Mark is just going, going, going. And what we're going to find is that Mark is a really, really gifted character developer. You know what I mean by that? He develops characters. The great stories do. What's fascinating is normally when you read a novel, you find that you're drawn naturally to identify yourself with the protagonist, okay? And we are, because we're egomaniacs. So we always want to identify with the good guy. So we get in there and we read a story. But what's interesting about Mark is that the way that Mark describes the disciples, they're not protagonists. They are not the good guys in the story. In fact, when you read Mark's gospel, pretty quickly, right out of the gate, you start to realize these guys are really dense, you know? They miss the obvious stuff. I'm reading it, I'm like, duh, and they're not getting it. And then you'll read along and you realize these guys are really weak, you know? They can't even stay awake in the garden with Jesus. These guys are deserting him, they're sinful, they're broken, and then you're reading and you're starting to realize, you know what? I can really relate to these guys. Like, thank you, Mark, for an honest depiction of human nature. An honest depiction of the struggle of trying to follow Jesus in the world. It is hard. I'm so thankful Mark told his story this way. Because we feel obstacles. I feel obstacles to my life as a Christian disciple. And here's what I want to do this morning, okay? What I want to do this morning is I want to share with you two of the main obstacles that I see as a pastor to Christians really living out that call to follow Jesus. Two obstacles, and I have a feeling that everyone here is going to connect with one of these, all right? So here they are. These are two obstacles, and we're going to overcome these this morning, and as we study the Gospel of Mark together, we'll get through these. But I think these are pretty common. So obstacle number one is what I'm going to call hyper-spirituality. That's an obstacle to discipleship, hyper-spirituality. And then obstacle number two, which we'll come to in a minute, is hyper-discouragement. Think of two extremes, okay? You got hyper-spirituality over here, and you got hyper-discouragement over here. And I think both of those could, for maybe for you, they could be keeping you from really identifying with this and really getting this. When Jesus comes and he says, follow me, I want you to be my disciple, it could be hyper-spirituality that is a barrier for you. Now, why? So let's talk about it. Hyper-spirituality is the notion that a disciple is an extraordinary Christian. A Christian who has somehow made a more spiritual commitment to Jesus, a bigger commitment, versus those B-team Christians over there who have made kind of a commitment to Jesus. You know, they're not as extraordinary, right? And we hear that and we think, that's ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense. Well, now, wait a minute. I read this week about a pastor who got up in front of his church. He was going to preach on discipleship, and he said, okay, I want a show of hands if you would consider yourself to be a Christian, don't do this, okay, don't raise your hands. But he just said, he got up, he said, raise your hand if you consider yourself to be a Christian. 90% of the room raised their hands. He's like, great. Now, keep your hand up if you consider yourself to be a disciple of Jesus. Well, then it got really awkward in the room, okay? And hands started to go down, and they were and back up and down and up. I don't know. What do you see? Is there a difference? And they started to get confused, and people looked embarrassed. Is it possible that in your life, if I were to say, do you consider yourself to be a Christian? You'd say, yeah, totally. But if I said, do you consider yourself to be a disciple of Jesus Christ? Would you be as enthusiastic in your response? Think about it. In my ministry over the years, here's one thing I've noticed, especially in the realm of discipleship ministries, ministries that teach the church how to make disciples in the church. They have a kind of language that they use that I think is really unhelpful, and it encourages this hyper-spirituality. And I see it more often than I would like. And what it is it's called the high-capacity person. And what I mean by that is there are these ministries that say, when you're going to go out and you're going to choose somebody and you're going to disciple them and you're going to make a disciple, choose the high capacity people. And you start to go, what does that mean? High capacity. And as I look into it, I realize the high capacity people, what that means is it's the high capacity givers, right? It's the high capacity leaders, the movers, the shakers, the super type A people. And these ministries, they're saying to the church, if you're going to invest time, precious time, pick out those super awesome A-team type people. Those are the people that you invest in. And then you start to go, well, wait a minute. What if I turn out to be low capacity, you know? And someone says, are you a disciple? And you say, no, I didn't make the cut. Apparently, I'm kind of low capacity, you know? Bummer. Sorry, you know? And you start to go, well, no, wait a minute. Did Jesus pick out high capacity people to follow him? Were these the high? Now, listen, if you're high capacity, don't feel bad about it. That's not what I'm saying. If you're high capacity, welcome, okay? But I want to be really clear here. Did Jesus depend on high capacity people to get the job done? No way. Look at verse 16 real quick, and let me just point this out. He's in Galilee, okay? He passes alongside the Sea of Galilee, which is an interesting place to make his premiere in ministry. Galilee was like podunk USA. It's not Lake Oswego, all right? It's not like, I won't name a town that it's like because I don't want to offend anybody, but I almost said one, but I didn't. Galilee is podunk. It's low capacity. And Jesus goes to the edge of a lake and he walks up to low capacity people, fishermen, all right? Not a lot of influence. Not a lot of money, and probably maybe on the lower intelligence scale, if you were fishing in this period of time, it meant you were no longer progressing in the educational system. You didn't make the cut. And so after you got to a certain place and they said, you know, you should go back to fishing because that's a little better. So they go back to the family business. So these guys are out here fishing, and these are the people that Jesus chooses. These are the people that Jesus approaches. So hyper-spirituality is an obstacle. And it's not only thinking about the identity of a person. Sometimes when we think hyper-spirituality, we can make a mistake in thinking that the activity of discipleship is supposed to be super uber spiritual stuff that we start doing. Now I'm a disciple of Jesus, and that means now I got to start like doing a bunch of amazing stuff, you know, religious stuff. And that's really kind of a problem as well. And that could be an obstacle for you. because maybe, you know, you feel like you're just sort of an average Joe. This week, I picked up a book I'd read before. I picked this book up again because a bunch of you said, hey, have you been reading The Divine Conspiracy by Dallas Willard? You might recognize this title. Really, really great book. And what I love about this book is that he has a sentence I'm actually going to put on the screen in just a second that is like, I feel like one of the really, really great ways to capture the heart of discipleship, okay? And so I'm going to share it with you, and I'm going to ask you to write this down and take it with you this week. I think this will be helpful. Here's how Dallas Willard would describe discipleship, okay? Discipleship is learning from Jesus to live my life as he would live my life if he were I. Isn't that interesting? Discipleship is learning. So disciples are learners, right? And when Jesus approached these men who were fishing, he came and he said, follow me, I'm going to teach you some stuff. So thinking of a learner, being an apprentice of Jesus, that's a good way to think about discipleship. And Jesus said, follow me because I want you to learn from me. And you're going to learn from me because when you follow me, what's happening is you're being invited into a relationship with me where you get the privilege of close proximity with Jesus. That is a great way to think about discipleship. Discipleship is like thinking about my life as if I have as close of a proximity to Jesus as those first fishermen did 2,000 years ago. And I live my life trying to be near Jesus, reading about Jesus, studying the word, reading the Gospel of Mark, coming to worship, hearing the sermons, spending time with other Christians. And as I do, I'm close to Jesus. It's a relationship. You know, the Christian faith, what makes it so different is that we're invited into this relationship with our Creator that is meant to be as real as the relationship that Peter and Andrew had with Christ. It's relational. And so you can put that definition back up. So discipleship is this idea of I'm close enough to Jesus that I can see him, see how he thinks. You know, the attitudes of his heart are coming out. And I start to take that, and then I line it up with my own life, and I start to go, you know, how am I doing? How do I compare there? So this is helpful, and I'll tell you more. I'm going to leave it up. Here's what I want to say to you. Discipleship does not mean that you go from here's my life today and all the things that I'm faced with, my relationships, my job, where I live, the struggles that I have, and now suddenly I have to be transferred into some realm where it's got to be uber, uber spiritual, and I have to start talking differently. I have to use a lot of vows and arts, you know, and it starts to just get really crazy. And I think what the goal of this is to say, no. Here's what Jesus wants you to learn. He wants every lesson that you learn in the next 14 weeks, he wants you to be thinking of your life right now, the context that you live in, your relationships. Who do you interact with? What are you struggling with? What challenges tomorrow morning when you wake up, what are you walking into? Discipleship would mean starting to think, what would Jesus do if he were me in this situation? And does that mean I should start to change the way I operate? Right? Somebody made a bracelet like that, WWJD. Somebody had a brilliant idea. It was cheesy and they were pink and green, but it's actually a pretty good idea to think about. What would Jesus do if he were in this situation? Now, think about this for a minute. Do you know this is really, really good news? for people who feel already really overwhelmed by their life? They come to church and they're barely getting here because of responsibilities they have that are many of them good, you know? I think about the single mom who makes it to church, you know? Happy Mother's Day, single moms. Happy Mother's Day to you, honestly. Think about this. Do you know how hard it is to make it to church when you're a single mom? To roll in here knowing, and maybe you're a single mom because dad abandoned you and left you with the responsibility that you're going to carry to take care of your children. And the last thing that you need is to roll in and have some pastor get up and paint a picture of discipleship that immediately makes you feel guilty because you're not doing enough really spiritual things in your life, right? And I think Jesus wants to do just the opposite. He wants to greet the single mom and say, listen, the things that you are doing, they matter so much. And what I hope you'll learn as you follow me, you'll learn that you have a source of wisdom as you follow me. You have a source of energy that you maybe didn't know you could draw on. You have a person that you can pray to, cry out to, complain to. You have a person that you can ask for help to evaluate my heart, my attitudes. Do I need to think about this situation differently? It's good news. Being a disciple, that call. Discipleship is for single moms. It's for people who are lonely. Discipleship is for people who are struggling with chronic illness, people who are in a broken marriage, people who are out of work. Discipleship is for people who are so burdened right now by the circumstances of their life. Discipleship is for you, okay? Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you right now to think about a situation that you're facing in your life. Just whatever the first thing that comes to you. Maybe it's a relationship, something at work. Maybe it's something in your neighborhood you're dealing with. It doesn't have to even be negative. It could be something exciting, challenging. I don't know. Think about that thing. And now think, okay, let's think about this now through the lens of Jesus. What would Jesus say to me about this today? What would Jesus instruct me about? Or if I went and read the Gospel of Mark and I saw Jesus interacting with people, the way he treated people who opposed him, who criticized him, people who came against his leadership. How did Jesus treat people who, you know, socially were below him or above him? How did Jesus operate? And then what does that mean for me? Your neighborhood is a great context because we have neighbors, right? So last week after the sermon, a woman in our church was very encouraged, and she went home and she thought, what can I do in my neighborhood with the Mark series starting? And apparently she bakes scones. So she went home and she baked scones. That's not a super spiritual thing to do. You know, she baked scones and then she made a little card that has like a silver edge around it. And she made this little card and it says, who is Jesus and why does he matter? And then it said, this summer at River West Church in Lake Oswego, pastors Adam McMurray and Christopher Kaufman will be answering these questions as they teach from the gospel according to Mark. And she put the address, service times, 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. right there. And then she took scones to her neighbors with the little card, you know. So if you had warm scones this week and you're here, welcome to River West. We're glad you're here. Welcome. Think of your context. Are you a dad with daughters and you're trying to figure out how to be a great daddy of little girls. You know how important that is? How important it is to be a great dad, a dad who loves his daughters the way Jesus would love them. We have this ministry at River West called the Daddy-Daughter Weekend. It's pretty epic, okay? Pastor Mike came to me a few years ago and he was like, we gotta do something to help the dads because they don't have a clue what they're doing. You know, these guys, they need help. We need to give them something, a handle to figure out how to be like Jesus' dad. So he was like, I have an idea. We'll call it the Daddy-Daughter Weekend. And they just were there last weekend. And it's, you know, last weekend, 50 dads went away to the beach with their little girls. I think it's like 5 years old to 10 years old, 11 years old. 50 dads, 54 little girls. A couple dads had two girls. We prayed for them, you know. They went off to the beach. And this thing is amazing. And the whole weekend is about helping these guys be a really Christ-like daddy. How important is that? There's a moment in the weekend where I wish you could be a fly on a wall at this thing. It happens on Saturday night, and what they do it every year, they take all the dads, and they put the dads in one room, okay? And they give the dads really, really feminine paper and markers and stuff, and they say, you're gonna write a love letter to your daughter. Yeah, and the dads are in there, and they just look panicked. And they're like, ah, and they just look so stressed out. And then Mike breaks out like glitter, and they're like putting glitter on this purple paper. And he'll come and he'll like, here, I have a couple ideas for you. You're really struggling. And they're in there and they're writing a love letter to their daughters. And then this year, Mike came in and he also had them make these little keepsake boxes, little memory boxes for their daughters, you know. Last year, they had to make necklaces. That was the year I was there. But this year, we upped the ante, and there's dads in there like sweating with glue and glitter, and they're putting these keepsake boxes together. And then there's a moment where the little girls have been in another room writing a letter to their dad. And then they open the door, and these girls come running out like a herd of elephants, you know? They just come running out, and they're looking, where's my dad? Where's my dad? And if you could, ladies, if you could be there, be a fly on the wall, these little girls come tearing out, and they run, and they jump into dad's arms, and all these little couples, they're like couples. They go off, and the dad reads this love letter to his little girl. It's so important. Now, does that sound hyper-spiritual? Because it's not. You know, that's just, we're just, at River West, what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, what does it look like to do what you're already doing in a way that Jesus would do it? How important, you know? So we have to rescue discipleship from hyper-spirituality. You're called to this. You are called by Jesus to follow. I'm going to take the next one very briefly. It's hyper-discouragement. There's hyper-spirituality, but there's also hyper-discouragement. And I don't even really have to talk about it that long because if you're in this place, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Discouragement. I'm not talking about normal discouragement. There's normal discouragement, and then there's hyper-discouragement. And hyper-discouragement would be the discouragement where you have failed so badly or something has happened that's so devastating that it feels like someone has their thumb on you and they're just holding you down. And you are just discouraged. You're so discouraged that the thought of Jesus inviting you to be a disciple, to be a follower, it just seems totally out of reach. And you might think, well, what can Mark teach me about discouragement, you know? And what does Mark know about failure? What does Mark know about failure? Well, actually, Mark knows a lot about failure. I'm going to tell you briefly the story of Mark, will you keep your finger in Mark chapter 1? And I want to go to Acts chapter 13. Mark is one of these characters in the Bible where he pops up enough that you can trace out his story. And what's amazing is his story is a story of epic failure. I mean, this guy was a total failure. And what happens in Acts 13 is that, actually, the very last verse of 12, I won't read this. You can go back later and read it. It's a great story. At the end of 12, Paul and Barnabas are going to go on a missionary journey, and Barnabas, they decide they're going to bring along this person, John Mark. Okay, that's Mark. In this time, you had two names, a Greek name and a Roman name. Mark was his Roman name. And so Mark is, he has kind of a positive start, like the disciples. He has a great start, and right out of the bat, he's kind of identified as a leader. Paul and Barnabas, they say, hey, we're going on a journey. Let's take John Mark with us. Well, if you read chapter 13, they sail from Antioch, which is on the Mediterranean coast, sort of modern-day Lebanon, and they travel west to the island of Cyprus. And the island of Cyprus was an island where there was a lot of really heavy spiritual activity going on. It was a wacky place. Paul and Barnabas start traveling to the island of Cyprus, and they have these really, really intense experiences. They're casting out demons. Paul at one point, like, basically curses a guy and says, you're going to be blind because you're coming directly against Jesus. And Mark panics. And in verse 13 of chapter 13, Mark goes home. He basically abandons them. Is it 13? And John Mark, he leaves them. He leaves and he goes back to Jerusalem. So you're like, whoa, what's the deal with that? And does Mark, what has Mark created here? He has no idea. So now flip to Acts 15 and let me read what happens to Mark. Acts 15, verse 36. Now, after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, same two guys, Paul and Barnabas, he says, let's go back. This is the idea of missionary journey number two. And Paul's like, we should go back to every place we visited. Let's go encourage all the Christians, and we'll do trip number two. Let's visit the brothers and sisters in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are. Now, Barnabas wanted to take with them John, called Mark. That's Mark. But Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord. It's a crazy story. This story, really, it tells us about one of the first major conflicts in the early church. And what's crazy about it is the whole conflict is caused by John Mark. And when you read the story, the first thing we focus on is we think, wow, I can't believe Paul and Barnabas couldn't like work out their differences. That's amazing. And it is, there's a lot to say about that, that there are times when conflict is normal. But what I thought as I read the story this week is I thought, well, now, wait a minute. What would it have been like to be Mark in that moment? You know, what would it have been like to know Paul thinks I'm a total loser? Paul thinks I'm not dependable. Paul thinks I'm not up to par to go with him. Paul, when he looks at my, you know, at my portfolio, he doesn't see enough that would make him want to bring me along. Paul thinks I'm not courageous. And you start to go, Mark knew exactly what discouragement feels like. He He knew what it would feel like to be a person who's trying to follow Jesus and you have this epic fail in your life where you question yourself and you go, am I up to par here? And for you, maybe that is a big mistake you made, you know? A blunder where you walked away and you went, oh. Maybe it's a sin, something that happened where you harmed someone, you broke confidence, you betrayed someone you love. And that can create super discouragement. Maybe for you, your discouragement is actually discouragement towards God. You're sitting here and you're thinking, I want to follow Jesus, but God has let me down. You know, I'm discouraged because I feel like God has not fulfilled his promises to me. And the idea of being a disciple, of following Jesus, that's not even on my radar. I'm barely wrestling with whether or not I think God is good or trustworthy. And I'm discouraged about it. Here's the amazing thing about this story, okay? Barnabas took Mark, and from Cyprus, we have historical documentation that says that Barnabas took Mark and they went to Rome. And you want to know who was in Rome? Peter was in Rome. And Barnabas introduced Mark to the Apostle Peter. And it just so happens that Peter also knew about epic fails, right? And discouragement. Think abandoning Jesus and denying that you ever knew him right before he goes to face his greatest suffering, and you don't even have the courage to say to an elementary school girl, oh yeah, I know him. Epic fail. And Mark hung out with Peter, and Peter told Mark all the stories, the real stories of what it was like to be a disciple. Failure, being dumbheaded, making mistakes, falling asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, thinking you can step out on the water and then you take your eyes off and you're sinking. All of these stories where you're reading them and you're realizing Mark knows everything about discouragement. And how do the Gospels end? They end with the risen Christ coming to Peter and saying, I still choose you to be my disciple. I still choose you. I love you, Peter. I love you. You're mine. Sister in Christ, brother in Christ, I want to say to you this morning that your mistake is no match for Jesus, okay? It's no match. He is going to overcome that with his grace. Your discouragement this morning is no match for Jesus. He is calling you to follow him. And it's a call of grace. It's an invitation into a relationship, all right? And my greatest hope, my greatest prayer this summer as we study the Gospel of Mark is you'll begin to realize I am no different than those original disciples. That call of grace, that call to discipleship is as real for me as it was for them. That's my prayer. Will you do this? I'm going to pray for you now. Miguel is going to come and lead us in worship. Will you bow your heads and let me pray over you this morning before we worship together? Lord, I think that we're beginning to understand the call to discipleship. Thank you for Mark. Thank you that we get to embark on a journey with his gospel where we're going to see in living color what it looks like to follow Jesus. And we'll learn lessons along the way. And I'm thankful. And I pray this morning for those who are here who have been walking with Jesus for a long time, I pray that you would encourage them today. Maybe the encouragement is in this idea of being close to Jesus, and maybe it's a gentle reminder to get even closer to Jesus. Reading the word, prayer, really thinking about him, following him, adoring him, looking to him as my model, my example. Encourage those of us who are on that journey, Lord. We would be more like Christ today. But I also want to pray for those who are here who have been sidelined, God, for any reason, sidelined because Christianity seems out of reach for them somehow, maybe intellectually, or maybe they feel like they don't measure up or something. Oh, Father, how I pray that what we would hear from you this morning is the call of grace. It's the grace that makes the gospel so unique. We're not called to you because of anything that's significant in us. You call us, Jesus, because you call us. That's it. And we're invited, and everyone here is invited, and I pray they'd hear that call. I pray for those this morning who are hearing all this and realizing, I don't know Jesus, I don't have a relationship with Jesus. Father, maybe today is the day that those words follow me. Oh, how I pray some would hear those this morning for the first time, and they would respond in faith. A simple prayer that says, yes, Jesus, I want to follow you. I need your forgiveness. I need your cross, your death, and your resurrection for my sins. I put my hope in you. Father, I pray for those who are hearing that they would lift up that prayer to you now, and as we sing together, that this might be the beginning of their journey as a disciple of Jesus. Bless us, I pray this morning. And I ask it in Christ's name. Amen.